On Tech News Today, the personal photos of more than 100 major celebrities have been leaked. Is it Apple's fault? Plus, Apple's partnering with the major credit card companies for its rumored mobile wallet product. Microsoft may be facing a contempt of court charge for refusing to hand over data stored abroad. And Ferguson police are now wearing body cameras. All that and more coming up right now.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Tuesday, September 2nd, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Citrix ShareFile. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with Citrix ShareFile. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the microphone, and enter TNT. And by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news of the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin. Jason Howell is back in the seat after long weekend of camping in the woods and hurting children.
Tried not to hurt children. They actually stayed out of trouble, thankfully. No, seriously. I was trying to keep them from hurting themselves. Yeah. I almost had one of them topple right into the fire. So, yeah, but I was right there to grab the arms.
That's right. probably lost a few marshmallows, though. And we also have with us Joe Panettiere because it is Tuesday, and Joe is our Tuesday co-anchor. Welcome, Joe Panettiere. How was your weekend?
My weekend was spectacular. Nothing to do with hurting children or anything like that, but quite good.
What have I done? Well, I'm so glad, and I'm here to ruin it for you. We're back into the news. Some of it is a real bummer, so let's just jump right into it. The FBI is investigating whether Apple's iCloud was compromised, enabling hackers to download and post pictures of more than 100 celebrities. The pictures were posted on 4chan and Reddit, and many are extremely personal photos involving nudity and sex. Actress Jennifer Lawrence, who is one of the victims, called it a, quote, flagrant violation of privacy, unquote, something of an understatement. Apple said they're investigating as well and also fixed a bug in the company's Find My iPhone feature that may have enabled the hack. Seth Weintraub is publisher and editorial director of the 9to5 site, and Polly Mossens writes for The Wire and other publications. Welcome to both of you.
Great to be here.
So we'll start with you, Seth. How likely is it that Apple's iCloud is the source for these photos?
It seems pretty likely at this point, but obviously we don't know until there's evidence one way or the other. I think the original hacker had said getting the information from iCloud, and just coincidentally, Apple fixed a 3 or 4 day old easy to brute force way to get into iCloud. So, I mean, all the stuff's there. It wouldn't be surprising if it's iCloud, but it's not definitely iCloud yet.
So one of the interesting parts of this is it may have involved password guessing, correct? So isn't that a relatively simple hack, so to speak? And shouldn't iCloud have been defended from something like this as a base security procedure from the start?
I think it is a pretty basic thing. It's even there's pictures of brute force is what it's called when people just start shooting passwords at accounts, and Find My iPhone is one of Apple's iCloud services, and it hadn't enabled the lockout after 5 or some number of tries. So yes, if this is the hack, then it was a pretty bad move on Apple's part. And frankly, we've got a lot of big Apple announcements coming up. I think this is going to rattle Apple people's faith in the company of doing security well.
And especially Hollywood's faith. I mean, Hollywood has a lot of faith. Polly Mossens, Hollywood is a famous Apple shop. Everybody in Hollywood, it seems like, uses, iPads, MacBook Pros, and iPhones. And this is one of the reasons, presumably, why so many celebrities were compromised and victimized by this hack, because they all use Apple, and this is apparently an iCloud hack. What do you think this is going to do, to Seth's point? What do you think this is going to do to the confidence that Hollywood and people in general have in Apple's cloud security?
I think we're definitely going to see some confidence lost, but we're also going to see a second part of this, which will sort of be the silver lining. We'll see Apple be able to push towards more people adopting two-step verification, which some have speculated would have actually avoided this leak. A two-step verification is essentially having someone log in with a password and then have a secondary device with a confirmation code. It can be texted to your phone, sent to an alternative email address, sent to an iPad, something like that. So that's the one thing we're going to see. We are going to see people lose faith, but we are also going to see people adopt extra security measures to protect themselves. I don't think we're going to see all of Hollywood immediately move to Android. It's just not that extreme, in my opinion. However, we will see additional security steps being taken, and perhaps they will become much more popular than they have been in the past.
Hey, jumping over to Seth, I'm curious, Seth, in terms of looking forward, one of the things that some of the, at least one of the victims mentioned was that she had deleted these photos years ago or previously, and yet these photos turned up leaked. Is that to suggest that there's some sort of caching system here at work where people may think they've cleaned up their system, but it's not because it's still hidden in iCloud somewhere? That's part A of the question. And part B is, do you think Apple will therefore sort of change how things are stored long term?
Well, I mean, so prepared to be frightened a little bit here. You know, okay. Once you have an iCloud login and password, you have access to a user's, you know, if they have a Mac, you have access to their time machine. So basically everything they've ever backed up ever, you know, that time machine caches, obviously it's going to start throwing away old stuff at some point. There's a lot of data that is behind that iCloud login and password. So just because it's not on your phone right now doesn't mean that somewhere in Apple's server cloud, it's not all of your stuff is somewhere. So and what was part B again of that?
Part B is, do you think Apple will take some steps to change that? Because you have individuals here, you know, novice consumers who will delete a photo from their phone and just assume it no longer exists.
Yeah, I don't know how you back up somebody's data and keep it, you know, for years and years. And also, you know, you need like an incognito mode for your camera or something. I don't see how you can do both.
So essentially what
it's a kind of a hard situation to rectify.
It absolutely is. And what it suggests at first blush is that the cloud is not ready for the consumer marketplace. You know, I think that the only thing that Apple can really do, well, there are a number of things they can do. The most likely one is to require two-step authentication. I don't know how likely that is. The other one that they can do is require separate passwords for various things. I mean, as I understand this story, basically what people are doing is they used one of the many places where Apple requires a password to crack the passwords, and then they applied that password to something like Time Machine or iCloud somewhere to get at all this data. That seems to be the outline of how this thing happened. And of course, how do you know, the user is always the weakest link in any sort of security system. And when you have all the data one password away, it's a recipe for disaster. And so Seth Weintraub, and then we'll get back to you, Polly, in just a sec. I have a bunch of questions for you. You know, you know Apple as well as anyone. Which route are they like? Are they actually likely to require two-step authentication?
I don't think so. I mean, Apple does have kind of something up its sleeve that it can really use, and that's Touch ID. You know, it's on the latest iPhones, and will probably be on the next round of iOS products. And there's a way to verify your identity through your fingerprint. And they could, you know, obviously do that in future Macs or whatever. But that's obviously, it would seem like that would be the way Apple would go. Another thing is Apple's got to get a lot better with security. You know, we've reported things to Apple before, and their security mechanism, you know, fixing mechanisms are a little bit of a joke. And in this case, you know, the GitHub thing was up for 3 or 4 days before they even addressed it. And, you know, all of this could have been avoided if they had just you know, shut that down right away. And even, I mean, you know, in the case of this particular one, they fixed it, I don't know, 3 or 4 days after it was public. But, you know, even a warning or you know, some other mechanism of alerting users would have been beneficial, I think.
Now, the hacker received the sort of the public attention as if he was receiving an Oscar or something like that. He said this is the result of several months of long and hard work by all involved. So apparently there's more than one person involved. And he said, quote, "We appreciate your donations and applaud your excitement. I will soon be moving to another location from which I will continue to post." And he's promised lots and lots and lots of more pictures. And this is, you know, this is a bit of a nightmare. Now, Polly Mossens, this I've kind of perceived a change in the public reaction to this particular leak. And of course, these things have happened over and over again, and it always happens in the same way. Basically, there's some kind of cloud backup for a phone. People take pictures of their phone. They don't think about the cloud backup. Somebody hacks into the cloud account, and then they get the pictures. It usually happens through the carrier's account, usually when carriers provide a backup service, a photo backup service, or a cloud-based storage of some kind. But in this case, I'm detecting a larger change in attempted change in the norms around how we respond to these kinds of things. And there have been a lot of articles about how it's extremely unethical to even look at these pictures because it's a violation of the of privacy. Now, of course, obviously it is. That's always been true. But suddenly there seems to be a sort of an agreed upon social norm that's emerging. Do you sense that as well? Or am I just perceiving something that isn't really there?
Absolutely. I think my coworker today, David Sims, wrote a wonderful piece about this in which he says that really using the word leak in itself is incorrect. We should be talking mm-hmm. about this as a theft. These are stolen photographs from someone's very private account. If you were to go into somebody's home and go through their photo album and remove pictures and then send them to their neighbors, we would be discussing that as a theft, not as a leak. And I think part of this is because sort of the star, quote unquote, of this leak was Jennifer Lawrence, who is right now America's sweetheart. She's very beloved. Her work is very successful and generally liked by a young female population. We're seeing a very major pushback against this theft. We're seeing a lot of young women rally and say, this is inaccurate, this is incorrect, we should not be promoting these pictures, we should not be circulating these. Even Perez Hilton, who has been known to publish just about any kind of photograph of a celebrity, removed the link temporarily. Jezebel has removed the link. We're seeing a very big push of people pushing back and saying, you know what, we can't be spreading this information. We can't be promoting the website. We can't be promoting, you know, sending money to the people that are spreading these around.
And in fact, Perez Hilton also promised to never again publish a nude celebrity photos on his site. So that's a big change because he's probably made a lot of money in the past on exactly those kinds of pictures. Polly Mossens writes for TheWire.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at PollyNYC. Thank you so much for joining us today, Polly.
Thank you very much.
All right, we're going to keep Seth around because we've got another big Apple story coming up in just a few minutes. But first, I want to tell you about Citrix ShareFile. Citrix, you just heard that story, folks. The internet is insecure. I hate to break it to you, but the internet is a bad neighborhood sometimes, and you can't just throw files, private files, whether of any kind, whether they're photographs or whether they're financial documents or no matter what they are, you can't just put them as an attachment to email and send them out and have any expectations that they'll remain secure. That's why you need to go to our sponsor's website, ShareFile.com, because the way they do it is you upload your file to a, not iCloud, to a secure cloud location, right? And it's password protected and also gives you all kinds of benefits as well, because when you upload it into the cloud and then you send a secure link to that individual, you can, if you choose, be alerted when they download it. You can tell how many people can download it, how often they can download it, for how long they can download it, and how many times they can download it. You have all the control over that file after you've sent it, and you know exactly what's happening to the file you sent. This is the secure cloud, and I mentioned a minute ago a question about whether or not the cloud is ready for prime time, and in fact, it is when security is done right, and that's how they do it at Citrix. Of course, Citrix is a well-known company for their security and for their robustness. And Citrix ShareFile is actually a super secure site that's very easy to use, very fun to use because it's really beautifully designed. And so, you know, if you're not using ShareFile yet, you need to sign up for a free trial right now. Now, no credit card is required to sign up for the free trial. You just go check it out. You can start sending files immediately, including enormous files. There are lots of companies that won't let files of a certain size through their firewall. You don't know what the size is. You have to just wait and hope that you see the error message that they may or may not bounce back. With Citrix ShareFile, you always get your files through, even if they're 5 gigabytes or 6 gigabytes or bigger, because you can, of course, send a secure link, and then the link, the download itself, can be a very, very large file. So get started today with our special 30-day free trial. Go to sharefile.com, click on the microphone. Make sure you click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and enter TNT. That's sharefile.com and type in TNT. Well, Joe, it looks like Microsoft is having lots of fun internationally. What's going on with Microsoft?
Yeah, you know, we got two updates on the international scene. One involves China and the antitrust case. The other involves data stored over in Ireland. And to give us to shed some light on the Ireland situation, we've got Jeff John Roberts from GigaOm with us. Jeff, how you been?
I'm doing real good. How you guys been?
We've been fantastic. Thanks for joining us. Hey, can you tell us, give us the overview, what's going on with Microsoft, Ireland, and I guess the U.S. legal system trying to get their hands on some of emails over in Ireland?
As with so many things these days, a lot of this spins out of Edward Snowden and those leaks. And it's on one front, it's sort of a trade war, and the other is a data war. The Europeans genuinely do object to the snooping and the data standards of the U.S., but also their cloud computing industry sees an opportunity to take some of this business from Amazon and Microsoft. So every time you see one of these clashes, keep that in mind. That's the context driving it. European data laws and European cloud computing industry kind of fanning the flames, as it were.
Now, okay. Go ahead. Go ahead, Jeff. Go ahead. You had more to say.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's the backstory. I should go right to your question, which is what's up with Ireland. The story is someone in the U.S. Justice Department's doing a narcotics investigation. For that investigation, they want to get hold of some emails that happen to be in a server located in Ireland. And from the whoever it is, the FBI or the Justice Department, doesn't really care. They're like, Microsoft, that's Hotmail or whatever it is. You just give us that stuff. Microsoft, for some reason, decided to make a big song and dance and said, no, we're not going to give you that because that's an Irish customer and that data resides in Ireland. And legally, they have a pretty good point, because normally a search warrant gives you authorization to search within a given space. But that space has always been within the U.S. borders. And what Microsoft is saying is like, no, you're asking to go rooting around in Ireland and your American search warrant doesn't cut mustard over there. So no. That's what Microsoft is saying, and that's what the court case is about. But the backdrop, again, is a larger fight about Europeans and privacy and the cloud computing industry.
Now, Jeff, as I understand it, they're facing a contempt of court charge. What happens if they are found guilty of contempt of court?
Microsoft is a very sophisticated company. I mean, they're not exactly sort of frontline, you know, civil liberties about to get arrested. This is very orchestrated. Microsoft's PR did a good job of fanning the story. And I wrote it because Microsoft is actually correct in this. It should be drawing attention to it. But what's going to happen? It's just a procedural question. Microsoft is saying no. So they're forcing the Justice Department's hand and forcing them to get a contempt of court order. So they'll probably get that. And then both sides are going to agree to put that contempt order on hold while it goes to the appeals court. So some of this is just legal theatrics, but it is Microsoft's doing a very good job of drawing attention to this issue and fanning the flames of it and getting it into the public attention. And every time there's one of these headlines, that's the signal to Europe and to data regulators and customers in Europe saying, hey, we have your back, Europeans. So it's sort of funny to see Microsoft as this sort of civil libertarian, but that's their jam these days. So.
Yeah. Isn't there another irony here? So as Microsoft feuds with the U.S. government, wouldn't it in fact be illegal under Ireland law to turn over these emails? Is that the case or is that not the case?
That's about right, because if you want to go get something in Ireland, the thing to do, I assume, I'm not an Irish lawyer, but would be go to a court in Dublin or something and say, hey, can we get a search warrant to get this stuff? In which case, that would be the proper way to do it. And that's what Microsoft is saying. They're like, okay, Justice Department, go talk to Ireland. Go under their mutual legal assistance treaty, work with them. And that's how, because the U.S. has a treaty with Ireland and many, most other countries to cooperate on criminal matters. And that's what Microsoft is saying that the U.S. should do in this case. So you're right, you put it well. The answer might be go to Ireland and work this out.
Now, this is clearly a case where it's on Microsoft's side because it's Irish data and is stored in Ireland. But what if it was an American company's or an American citizen's data stored in Ireland? Or what if it was an Irish citizen's data stored in the United States? Would that change this case?
I think so. You're kind of on some cutting edge stuff there. But I think if it's an Irish person that's located in the U.S., just in, if like an Irish citizen was somewhere in Chicago and had stuff in a locker and they got a search warrant to search it, you could do that because it's on American soil. I think the problem here is going overseas to look at it. That's the problem. And if it was an American citizen stuff overseas, I'm not sure. But I think we're going to see a lot of court cases in the next year or two defining what the rules are of where you can search in the cloud. It's kind of a fiction because the cloud is everywhere. And that's what the Justice Department's saying. It's like, hey, give us a break. You can see that from where you are in Seattle or wherever. So just show it to us. But technically, the data stays on the server over there. So that's where we are right now.
Yeah, you know, and you bring up this cloud angle, and and you mentioned that at the top of the story. What does this overall mean? You've got Microsoft's cloud growing exponentially. You got Amazon's cloud growing exponentially. Google growing quickly. Companies like Rackspace expanding internationally. Basically, are we seeing here an effort by each country trying to stand up and get some cloud business going in its own country against those foreign players by using debates like this and saying, hey, don't worry, we'll protect your data when the U.S. government comes calling?
Yeah, it's turning into a competitive advantage. And for consumers, that's a good thing. We're actually seeing companies compete on privacy. But if you want to be cynical, part of it is Europe saying, wait a minute, we missed the cloud computing industry boat. These are all American companies. This would be a good way to give our guys a leg up. And if we can exclude the American companies through fear, through propaganda, or through legitimate data complaints, I mean, that's the cynic's view of it, but I think there's some truth to that.
I like the cynic's view, personally. China has also been given, has given Microsoft 20 days to answer questions related to an antitrust probe in that country. We've been covering the antitrust issue in China. It's not just Microsoft that they're picking on. They're going after all kinds of companies, both technology. They're going after car companies. They seem to be on a big push for antitrust probing and legislation. What does this mean that they've, Jeff John Roberts, that they've been, that they've given Microsoft 20 days to reply? And what do you think of this case generally? Is this a fair case in your opinion, or is China just kind of making a lot of noise for political reasons?
I would say almost certainly the latter. You should probably get a Chinese lawyer on or some authority in sort of Chinese matters. My two cents are I'm very cynical whenever it comes to China making a song and dance about intellectual property or antitrust law, because China likes to invoke the rule of law and compliance and things like that. But when it comes to basic political freedoms or, you know, basic sort of fair courts, China doesn't even have those. So whenever I see one of these cases, it might be Apple and trademark or Apple's and patents or Microsoft or Google and antitrust. It's typically, I think, a signal to the company, look out, the Chinese government is going to squeeze you unless you do what we want about something the rest of us don't know about. I assume this is China was or Microsoft was probably making too much of a song and dance about pirated Windows or who knows what. And in this case, this is simply a way for China to provide some political cover and squeeze Microsoft in return. And it's the Chinese government, so they're going to do what they want. But that's just my opinion. I'm no authority in foreign relations or Chinese law. But given that China is very poor in terms of rule of law in the first place, I would, in this case especially, go for the more skeptical motive.
Jeff John Roberts writes at GigaOhm.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Jeff John Roberts. Thank you so much for joining us, Jeff.
Thanks, guys. My pleasure.
Apple is partnering with both Visa, American Express, and MasterCard for its mobile wallet product. Apparently, Visa and American Express are working together there. According to Bloomberg sources, the mobile wallet, which lets you buy things at stores using an iPhone instead of a credit card, might be announced next week. Seth Weintraub is still with us to talk about this story. Seth, can you describe this mobile wallet based on the little pieces of the elephant that we've been able to perceive so far?
Well, what we know, and Mark Gurman did some great reporting on this back in May before everybody else kind of jumped on. But from what we know, Apple's got big partners. It sounds like they're going to put NFC hardware in the iPhone 6. So, you know, with the partnerships and the hardware, you really need just a layer of software, and you have basically what Google Wallet was or is. And then, you know, with Apple's marketing and their software being cohesive, and, you know, up until recently, people had a lot of faith in Apple. So, you know, that kind of puts together a better package. I also think, you know, one of the things that Apple's really good at, probably the best at, is knowing when to jump on a technology. So, you know, our sources told us that they had actually had an NFC chip ready for the iPhone 5, but they didn't think the ecosystem was there yet. So 2 years later, I think the ecosystem's there. You know, all the major credit card companies, American Express, Visa, MasterCard, are rolling out these NFC readers. And I think there's some legislation in 2015 that's hitting soon that's going to require, it's not going to require, but it's going to put the fraud onus on the owners if they don't have NFC or chip card readers. So that's going to encourage that last, you know, 40-50% of retailers to install some sort of card reader or chip reader technology. So it's kind of all coming together. And I think if Apple, unless this latest security thing blips out everything, I think Apple's ready to release it as part of, you know, one of their packaged apps and, you know, on a system level as well.
Yeah, so Seth, you bring up the million or multi-million dollar question here, and that is, how does the alleged iCloud hack potentially pertain to this and potentially impact the digital wallet or the mobile wallet going forward? Do you think Apple will need to refine its messaging when this is announced? You know, there's always that danger. It's almost like the airline industry. You don't want to claim to be you're the safest airline out there, because God forbid you have a bad day and you lose a plane. But how might Apple, A, change its messaging, and then B, NFC? 90% of our viewers and listeners, I think, know what NFC is, but can you explain a little more and what type of messaging we might get around that in terms of how Apple will talk about security and ease of use, and et cetera?
Sure. NFC is near field communication. It's a technology that's been around for a while. A lot of almost every Android maker has NFC in their phones, and it's used for other things, like kind of like what iBeacons are doing now. But if you're a lot closer, you can put your phone up to a NFC beacon. So, I mean, it's a technology that's pretty mature. There's been some security back and forth on it, and, you know, there's been problems, there's been fixes. As far as, you know, if Apple gets into the game, obviously they're going to be pretty hardcore about the security. I can't remember who it was, but somebody said that the credit card data and the NFC, you know, the financial data would be stored on a special area of the iPhone, kind of like where the thumbprint is for the Touch ID. You know, and that would avoid it going up to the cloud or doing any of those things that have been causing problems recently.
Well, it's going to be an interesting announcement for sure. We'll see how they spin it. And I think personally, they actually have a pretty good message by insisting on two-step authentication and saying essentially we have the best fingerprint reader, we have the best biometric solution for a mobile wallet solution. I mean, again, this is the use of an iPhone in a brick-and-mortar store. You got the iPhone, you got the fingerprint reader right there. It's actually pretty secure, theoretically, if they make it as secure as it can possibly be. Now, before I send you a pack in here, Seth, I want to just mention the big event on your website, 9to5Mac, in the past week, which was Mark Gurman's awesome expose on Apple's PR program over the years called Seeing Through the Illusion, Understanding Apple's Mastery of the Media. What a piece that was. That was really incredible.
Yeah, I really couldn't believe it as it was coming together. He had been working on it for 2 months, and you know, this looks like one of those, you know, book excerpts or something that Stephen Levy or Fred Vogelstein would do. And, you know, seeing it coming out of a 20-year-old was pretty remarkable. And, you know, like, it pretty much lays the bare, like, what you and I know. A lot of journalists know the situation. But I think it's good for the general public and the following crowd to understand how PR works, and especially with Apple, how it kind of manipulates what you read and how you get news, because they kind of control this whole, I mean, you know, the level of control Apple has over the media is unprecedented. And I think perhaps not very good, you know, for the general public to not be aware of. So, you know, this thing was great and on so many levels.
Yeah, and part of the way that they control people is by a blacklist, which I've written about and which Mark Gurman is no doubt now on for life. And I appreciate his integrity in writing this and your integrity in publishing it. It's a really important issue that a lot of journalists are afraid to write about, and you guys weren't afraid to write about it. So I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right, Seth Weintraub is at 9to5google.com and 9to5mac.com. And you can follow him on Twitter at LLSethJ. Thank you so much for joining us today, Seth Weintraub.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Well, Joe, it looks like Ferguson got some new hardware, and it's probably something we could all have predicted.
Yeah, and let's hope it comes with the proper battery and power support along the way. So the update is police officers in Ferguson, Missouri have started to wear body cameras, Mike, and those body cameras are being worn amid continued protests over the fatal Michael Brown shooting 3 weeks ago. You know, there's a lot of different angles here to this story, but one of them that jumped out at me is number one, there are a lot of petitions going around the U.S. right now to have all U.S. officers equipped with some sort of camera equipment so that when an altercation occurs, there's a video and audio recording of it or record of it. But the other thing here is we want to be careful that we don't position technology as a fix-all. And then I think we're also going to see a much more closely analyzed look at police budgets. Because one of the angles that came up, Mike, in some of the coverage over these cameras being rolled out is it turns out that this particular police department actually had cameras I guess in-house, ready to be installed in their cop cars, but they couldn't be installed because there was no budget for them. I mean, how backwards is that?
Yeah, I'd like to see somebody like Bill Gates turn his attention to something like this and maybe fund a project like this. Personally, I don't think that a federal requirement on local and state police is the right way to go politically, but I would like to see state police embrace this sort of thing. You know, one of my ongoing themes that I'm always harping about is the fact that whenever there's a new technology, whoever it is that's in power, whether it's the government or corporations or police departments, whoever it is, they always see that shift in technology as an opportunity to overcome a balance that used to exist between them and whatever it is their adversary is, whether it's the public or whatever, and they get this advantage. Let me give you one example. Used to be, I don't know, 100 years ago, there were no video cameras. There was no cheap way to record things. And so the whole process of arresting someone and charging them with a crime and interrogating them was all off the record. There was no recording of it at all. So it was one, the cop's word against the suspect's word. They would go to court. They would each give their side, and then a judge would decide whose side ruled the day. Then it became standard over, you know, through the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s to put video cameras in interrogation. Now the police were in control of that technology. They could turn it off when they were going to do something illegal, plug it in when the perp was going to make himself look bad, and they had control over it. And so you see a change in the balance of power between the public or suspects and the police. Now the police have the power because they've granted themselves somehow a monopoly on surveillance technology. And so my argument has always been, let's not allow these changes to happen. We've got lots more technology coming out over the next 5, 10, 20, 30, 50 years. And each one of those changes, if each one of those changes involves a change in the balance of power in favor of authorities and against the public, then, you know, we're headed toward a bad situation. And so I think that everybody ought to record everything. First of all, it is legal in almost every case to record the police when they are in public, even though many police officers will tell you that that's not true, but they are wrong about that. It is legal. And so I would like to see not only police having cameras on their person, if it can be funded, but to have them not be able to control when it's turned on and turned off. And I would also, you know, I want everybody to come into court with their recordings, not just one side or the other. Both sides should say, here is the recording. And I think the judges and juries would get a much better sense of what actually happened in these cases. And I think in many, many cases, there would be a lot more sympathy for the police officer because they have to face a lot of dangers and a lot of crazy people out there. And this could be demonstrated. You know, sometimes they go in there like, oh, why'd you shoot the person? And so, oh, he was really dangerous. Well, you give juries a sense of just how dangerous people can be. Or in the case of police brutality, they could be convicted for that. I'd just like to see everybody have surveillance technology on all sides, and this is a good start.
Well, you know, it's ironic that you mention sort of multiple angles of video, right? You've got the defense and the prosecution, and maybe they're both armed with video, for lack of a better metaphor. But you know what it reminds me of, ironically enough, is just this weekend I was watching a special from NFL Films talking about the Immaculate Reception, which was Franco Harris, the Pittsburgh Steelers, caught this ball that rebounded off someone else. No time left in the game. He scores a touchdown. Well, there was terrible camera angles, and you couldn't quite see what happened in the play, and the referees took 15 minutes to rule on it. Well, here we are 40 years later, and additional angles of that play have emerged. And what you saw in the original angle versus what you see in the new angles sort of tell different stories here and there. And I think that reinforces the fact that even video evidence can be called into question. Now take the situation in New York, for instance. A couple months ago, a 350-pound man, Eric Garner, was basically strangled by the police. And Mike, to your point, that could have been a he said, she said in court. But there is video evidence from a bystander. And I think very often in court, one of the challenges is when you have witnesses, the jury then has to decide whether the witness is credible. Well, what if four or five people in this particular New York case, came in and said the police strangled this person with a chokehold, but they didn't find the witnesses credible? That could be a really dangerous and sad situation. But here we have some what appears to be conclusive video evidence. But then again, I don't want to paint video as this magic solution because, to your point, Mike, I think you need the multiple viewpoints.
I think you do, and I think that, once the cost of camera, electronics, wireless technology, and all these other technologies get cheaper, cloud storage gets cheaper, I think it'll be super feasible from a financial point of view. And at the very least, I would like to see cameras on guns. If they can't afford to put a camera on the shoulder or on the chest of every police officer, at least put them on the gun so that when the gun is drawn, the camera starts rolling and the video starts to go. So at least we can see those encounters. Usually when police pull their guns, they stop before I shoot kind of thing. There's time before any shooting starts. And so there are solutions to this that may involve video. But again, I think the biggest danger is more on the side of a lack of video and also on the imbalance between who has and who controls and who's allowed to record video. And so once again, I think Moore's Law is going to come to the rescue to a certain extent to solve part of the problem. But I agree with you. It's not an ultimate solution here. It's also comes with risks because people will oftentimes give way too much credence to video evidence, think, I saw it. Well, maybe you didn't see it. Maybe you didn't see it all. Maybe you didn't see it from all angles. And so, it is an interesting story. And by the way, you talked about the cost of the Ferguson cameras. They were, in fact, donated. I don't think Ferguson can afford these cameras. So we'll be watching to see where this goes. And, of course, this has been tested all over the world. In the UK especially, bobbies have been wearing cameras in some cases for a while. And a lot of police dogs have cameras now. So You know, it's doable now thanks to wireless technology, cheap storage, cheap video cameras, and cheap electronics. We can do it, and I think we should do everything we can.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, my closing thought on that actually is yes, we've got the technology, but, you know, one thing comes to mind. You remember a few days after that Michael Brown shooting. Now, I'm one of those guys who says, you know what? Tragic situation. The police officer, of course, deserves due process here. We can't assume guilty until proven guilty. He's innocent until proven guilty. But here's one of the scary things that came out of this was, if you remember, 3 or 4 days after the shooting, basically the police released stills of Michael Brown pushing someone in that deli or that convenience store, and it looked like some threatening still images. Right. And this really upset the local citizens, because when you watch the actual video, you know what? Michael Brown did push someone in that video, but it wasn't nearly as threatening as those stills showed. So wherever we go here, whatever the path forward is, we just have to be careful how the data is going to be managed.
That's exactly right. And I think, just to expand on your theme there. The fact that the police were in control of that video, they released it for reasons completely unrelated, well, theoretically unrelated to the actual shooting. And they were accused, and I think with some justification, for releasing that to sort of tarnish the image of the person so we would care less that he was gunned down, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, again, who controls the video? That is the whole question. And so we want video technology. But most importantly, we want video technology that serves everybody and not just the police or not just the government or not just corporations for that matter. So, we live in a surveillance society now, and we need to figure out how to do it right and make sure that we don't allow surveillance technology to get completely out of control. Some would say it already is completely out of control, but believe me, it can get much more out of control than it is now. Well, in just a sec, we're going to tell you about a new wearable device that will kind of blow your mind. But first, I want to tell you about Personal Capital. Personal Capital is going to help you make and keep your money. And the way they do it is they help you bring it all together into one place. Your money is scattered all over the place. You don't know what's going on. You've got 401k over here. You've got a savings account over there. You've got investments. You've got money everywhere. And how are you doing? Are you gaining it? Are you losing it? Are you unnecessarily losing money? Personal Capital will help you get a handle on all of that. They bring all your accounts together so you can look at all your money, your whole financial picture, on a single screen. That screen can be on your computer, your phone, your tablet, whatever you like. And these are intuitive graphs that really show it all together so you can see what's happening. You can see the trend lines of your own finances as if you personally were a Fortune 500 company. They also help you save money on the fees that you're probably paying. You're almost certainly paying too much in fees and penalties and all kinds of things, and they will help you do that. Now, Personal Capital is also ahead of the curve in terms of wearable technology. They were one of the first companies to have an Android Wear supporting application for Android. I've been using it. It's awesome. When anything happens to your money, you need to worry about, and they're not bugging you all the time. They hardly ever notify you, but when something happens that you need to know about, they buzz your wrist, and there's the information right there at your wrist, and you can take action immediately and save yourself money, save yourself headaches. It's really a fantastic application of wearable computing. So no need to wait. Signing up takes just a minute. It pays big dividends, and of course, it is free. To set up your free account, go to personalcapital.com/TNT. Personal Capital is the smart way to grow your money, and we thank Personal Capital for their support of Tech News Today. A company called Moda plans to unveil a smart ring. Yeah, like a ring on your finger at IFA this week. The ring apparently works like a smartwatch, showing notifications with both icons on a screen. That's right, the ring has a screen. And also, it notifies you with vibration alerts. The ring supports both iOS and Android. What do you think, Joe Panettiere? You going to be wearing a smart ring anytime soon?
Well, I tell you, Mike, if you would have told me this 2 weeks ago, I would have said, I think wearable computing is overrated. It's hyped. And then, as you know, I was in Disney World last week wearing those magic bands that helped me to navigate the parks, get me in for food to various restaurants, etc. So I am gradually turning into a wearable computing believer. But I think it's all about the apps rather than the device. Give me killer applications, and I will consider the device. So I'm curious to see just how well the apps or the use case scenarios pan out for this device.
I also don't believe, I simply don't believe that the actual ring that they announce will be as slick and high resolution and as functional and beautiful as what they're showing in the CGI images on their website. It just looks too perfect. It looks like, you know, it looks like retina quality display on this ring. And you can imagine the battery issues, you can imagine other issues, but I just don't believe it's going to be as awesome as they make it look.
Yeah, it looks like Jason produced that those mock-ups. They look great.
Jason, what do you have to say for yourself? What have you done?
Well, I mean, all I can say is I wear a thumb ring and get mocked for it a lot, right? So wearing that beast on your finger, I have to imagine you're going to hear a few words from people. But maybe that's just because we're not used to seeing wearable rings yet, so like wearable devices on your finger.
Yeah, I don't, and I also don't see the advantage over a wristwatch unless you, for some reason, just don't want to wear a wristwatch.
But, I mean, I suppose if the screen was like so incredibly high res that you could get the text down, but it looks, the way they're showing it off, it's kind of like a marquee thing, right? So I can only, all I can envision, and I guess we'll find out more, is, you know, a Facebook post comes through and then you're just staring at your finger while it marquees across the entire post. But I guess it works for ReadQuick, right? So there you go. Maybe that's what they need to do. Integrate ReadQuick into the ring.
That's a great idea. We'll tell Natalie and her husband about that. So that's a great idea. Great ideas. Here at Tech News Today, we've got a lot of great ideas.
You're welcome.
Yeah, yes. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Sam Smith in Glasgow, Scotland, who posted this picture in the Tech News Today community on Google+. He said he was testing out his new HTC One M8. Look at that. Joe Panettiere, look at that. Big smile.
Hey, I got a quiz for you, actually. Yeah. A quiz for our viewers, not so much for our listeners, but our viewers. So someone on Twitter a couple of weeks ago said, Joe, you're way too corporate. Lose the jacket. And I pointed out that, hey, you know what? I tend to wear a jacket whenever I'm traveling at IT events. It's where I wear a jacket on the show. But the past 2 weeks, I've gone very casual, as you can see. As people are submitting their Tech News Today, how they view it, tell me whether you prefer casual or dressed up Joe or neither.
And you were the most corporate looking co-anchor. Of course, I'm always corporate looking. It's just how I roll here. But you were the most dressed up of the co-anchors, I think. And now you've gone casual, and that's totally cool. But yeah, everyone will let you know, I'm sure. We have a very vocal audience. Well, how do you watch or listen to TNT? Just take a picture of your setup, post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Don't upload it into iCloud, though. Use the hashtag, #HowDoYouWatchTNT, and we will find it. You can also search the hashtag, #HowDoYouWatchTNT, and see them all for yourself. And that is the Tech News Today. Well, thank you so much, Joe Panettiere. Great look at that. See, he's out of control, this Jason.
Oops. Switching the wrong part. Never mind.
Right on cue.
It's not working.
Imagine a phone around here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'll have to work on that.
So, Joe, thank you so much, and welcome back from back to reality from Disney World, and we'll see you next Tuesday.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Jason, take care as well.
All right, you too, sir.
All right, well, Samsung, Sony, and Asus all have big announcements tomorrow, so tune in to live.twit.tv all day for that news. Or better yet, subscribe to Tech News Today on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, Feedly, Yahoo, RSS, or many other options, or subscribe to them all. Choose your favorite way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. You can also follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV, and please send us your thoughts and opinions and pictures. Send email to tnt@twit.tv or leave voicemail 260-TNT-SHOW. You'll miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. My name's Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.